Australia has seen more than one Prime Minister rise and fall on their decisions about climate change policy. But as this year's election draws nigh, have we reached a tipping point when it comes to public opinion on what's been one of the most polarising issues of the last decade? We'd love to hear from you on this. In the lead up to May 18, what do you think is needed to address climate change while keeping energy affordable? Tell us on our Facebook page. With us today to nut this out is Rebecca Huntley. She's a social researcher and expert on social trends and the author of Australia Fair, Listening to the Nation, in the latest quarterly essay. Rebecca, welcome to Life Matters.
Hilary, thanks for having me.
And Matthew Warren is with us too. He's an economist and journalist. His latest book is called Blackout: How is Energy-Rich Australia Running Out of Electricity? Both of these books are surprisingly amusing reads given the subject matter. Welcome to you as well, Matthew.
Thanks, Hilary.
Now, Rebecca, you've been conducting polls for years asking Australians what they think about climate change. In the latest research you conducted, have you seen anything change?
Well, I mean, some things have remained relatively consistent over time. So for example, most of the polling I've done or research I've done and all the research coming out of universities and other reputable polling agencies show that a majority of Australians believe climate change is happening, and a majority of that majority think that we have some contribution towards climate change. So it's human caused. That, interestingly, has remained reasonably stable despite what's happening politically with climate change over the period that I've been kind of looking and conducting polls, which is about 15 years. What does change is whether people think it should be a political issue, whether it ranks high in their list of issues when they think about voting, whether it be at a state or federal election.
And what's contributed to that shift, do you think?
Well, look, I think there's two things that happen that make climate change become a political issue for people. The first is extreme weather events or a particularly hot summer. Australians are getting used to being told constantly, oh, well, this was a record-breaking summer and so forth. They don't think the Bureau of Meteorology has been infiltrated by the extreme left, I've got to say. They generally trust Australia agencies that look at these, these kinds of issues like the CSIRO and so forth. So when we have a kind of a particularly difficult period, and so, for example, the bushfires in Tasmania probably rank up as a kind of trigger effect, and then also when they see there's political inaction. So I think the fact that the government had a kind of looked like it was kind of inching towards getting the energy guarantee up, and then it kind of fell apart. So whenever there's a political kerfuffle around energy or climate, the combination of those two things means that climate and environment inch up that kind of list of top priorities when people think about their vote.
Now, a lot of people listening, Rebecca, are going to be saying, well, surely it would depend who Rebecca spoke to about that. And people sometimes have an assumption that a lot of people don't care about climate change. How did you work out that the people you spoke to were representative?
Well, you don't even have to take, you know, if you don't want to believe me, you can believe the Australian Electoral Survey run by Professor Ian McAllister out of the ANU. You can believe the Lowy Institute that have looked at this issue over time with their poll. I mean, the thing is, when you do a meta-analysis of all the polls, they tend to show pretty consistent things. The CSIRO themselves conducted a very large piece of research, longitudinal research, on climate change, and all researchers who are part of the community and are properly trained use samples that reflect the census data on the voting population. So the census tells us every year how many people are of a particular age, how many people live in rural and regional Australia, how many people are from a, you know, second generation migrant background or whatever. And whatever sample we use is weighted to reflect that voting population. And the one thing I would say on this, and I address it in my quarterly essay, there's a lot of cynicism about the accuracy of polls, mainly because Australians look at things like Brexit, and they look at things like the surprise result in the last presidential election, and they say, well, polls aren't accurate. The reality is national polls in Australia and national surveys are pretty accurate, like incredibly accurate, mainly because we have compulsory voting and Australians turn up to the ballot box, and most of the time they vote formally. So we pretty much know what we're talking about. But like I said, if you don't want to believe me, you can believe all those other experts that I mentioned just then.
And Matthew Warren, you've got a rare perspective because you've worked for everyone from the Minerals Council to energy industry peak bodies to the clean energy side of things, and you've been lobbying for a national climate and electricity policy for over a decade. What kind of changes are you seeing?
Yeah, look, I think what we're seeing is that, you know, obviously public opinion ebbs and flows. The last big shift was the Millennium Drought in 2006, and really that was when Australians first thought that climate change wasn't just real but happening to them at right now. And they couldn't fill their, because of water restrictions in Sydney and Melbourne, they couldn't fill their pools, they couldn't water their gardens. And off the back of that, we saw Kevin Rudd elected, and we saw this enormous swing in public sentiment around climate change. The problem was, delivering on those policies was challenging. The global financial crisis really crippled Rudd's ability to get a emissions trading scheme in. There was a brief moment there in around 2008 where we had missed the opportunity for political detente and bipartisanship. I mean, and it's worth remembering, I was reflecting on this yesterday, that when climate change was sort of first identified by scientists back in, James Hansen from NASA reported to a congressional hearing back in 1988 saying, look, we're pretty sure that we're warming the planet with human activity, and Hansen's modelling on 1988 has proved remarkably accurate, so he's pretty much nailed it. And off the back of that, it was the front page of the New York Times. George Bush Sr. Signed the first UN Convention on Climate Change. So there was Margaret Thatcher said we need to act on climate change. This was a bipartisan issue until we had to start fixing it. And we just need to accept that the political division that's arisen has not been from the science. It's been from the challenge, the enormous disruption that comes from trying to decarbonise carbon-intense economies.
Also, though, Matthew, you were environment reporter at The Australian for a time. If the parties are out of step with voters on climate, how much responsibility does the traditional media in Australia have for that?
Oh, look, it's a complex... This is the problem. It's a very complex story. And, I mean, we started off so well because, getting into trying to explain the climate science, I was asked to do it at The Australian repeatedly, and it's impossible. It's just impossible. It really is. Like, you can pick one aspect of one debate and get 1,000 words, and you've barely scratched the surface.
So it's about trust in the scientists.
Look, I liken this to thinking about air traffic control. We sit on planes, and the planes taking off and landing and flying around the sky, I got no idea how they do it. I just know they're really good at it. And I think there's a point at which we say, look, the climate science is experts who've identified this, and the thesis is over 30 years, I've not seen anyone come and successfully challenge it. In 2006, the business community, the reinsurance industry, reviewed its actuarial risk, and it started to notice the cost of insuring from weather events was going through the roof far faster than the rate of growth in the assets they're insuring. And then in that year, they said, look, whether you think climate change is real or not, we are going to factor in climate risk into financing and refinancing and insurance risk. And since then, you may have noticed the business community has basically said we need to move on climate change because they're managing it as a risk management issue. So we now have at least some of the politics completely out of step with both business, how we run our economy, and it's this weird sort of disconnect that so there's an ideological base arguing against a fairly comprehensive shift to reform the world economy.
I just want to pick up on one point, Rebecca, that you mentioned in your essay. You say that we're big believers in government action in Australia, but I think conservative voters are often a bit less happy about governments steering the economy in particular directions. And we've seen, as we said, more than one PM get punished when they try to act on climate change. What makes you think voters won't do that again this election?
Look, I think what we have to be careful about is reading public reaction to something like Julie Gillard's carbon tax as purely just a reaction to the idea that there'll be a tax on carbon. And the other thing I think we need to recognise is that, and Matthew said this, every time people can agree there's a problem, they're going to react, sometimes negatively, to the kinds of changes that need to happen, whether it be to the economy or to our behaviour, that's required to meet that. And there's always going to be an initial kind of, pushback. So, for example, there's been, and that can be on anything, we've seen it in on issues like, single-use plastic bags and all the rest of it. The question is the path of reform is incredibly complex and difficult. The question is how, you know, you push people through that reform process, knowing that you have social license to end up where you want to go, which is for most Australians, the idea that we would have, you know, most of our energy or in the future coming from renewables. So I think that even, I mean, what's interesting to me, and I delve into this, even amongst Conservative voters, there's a recognition that there's a role for government. I think Conservative voters often recognise that there's an opportunity cost and a real loss when we don't see that the business community want to go in a particular direction. And obviously the business community can't do that on their own. They need government action, they need a kind of policy framework, and they need some stability about that. So you see different parts of the community moving ahead, and they can't. There's a limit to how far they can go if all levels of government don't recognise that this is a genuine threat. And the perception is that some parts of the government are still arguing about whether the threat is real or not.
We're talking with Rebecca Huntley, social researcher and author of the latest quarterly essay, Australia Fair, Listening to the Nation, and Matthew Warren, an economist and journalist. His latest book is called Blackout, How is Energy-Rich Australia Running Out of Electricity? And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this too. In the lead-up to the election, what do you think is needed to address climate change while keeping energy affordable? Join the discussion on our Facebook page. Matthew, in your book, you talk about basically the fact that government's not either doing what's popular or what's in our best interests of the country. Is there something a bit broken about our political system if those two aims are not being met?
I think this is, the current government, I mean, this has certainly proved challenging for the coal. Look, it's as you pointed out in the introduction, it's been a killing fields for not just the Australian governments, but governments around the world. I mean, Bill Clinton tried to bring the first thing, I mean, in 93, the first political act of the Clinton administration with Al Gore as his deputy was to bring in an energy tax to start moving towards action on climate change. And Clinton and Gore were wiped out by a Congress who said no. Obama tried to bring in, it was looking at bringing in emissions trading and carbon pricing. And he eventually defaulted and went to health policy. You know, this has been, the Europeans have introduced an emissions trading scheme, and then after the GFC basically set it to zero because the weaker economies couldn't cope with the price. So this has proved absolutely lethal, both in policy and political terms. Australia's been pretty acute.
Is that because here it often gets distilled into a coal versus renewables dichotomy? Oh,
yeah, God. I mean, this is it really is. I kind of liken it to the Ford versus Holden tribalism of the 20th century. You know, I mean, it's about as meaningless as that. Australia's historically, because we've basically, the East Coast is covered with black and brown coal underneath. It's just the way it is. And we've built very coal-intense electricity system. And that puts us in the invidious position of having to move faster and unpack sort of a fairly stable but high-emission system faster than other countries. We don't have a lot of hydro. We have rules about nuclear power, which we may have to change. So we've kind of got this. And so we've ended up with this bizarre, where without intending to, we are now a global experiment in integrating renewable energy.
And South Australia has seen the challenges of that.
Absolutely. It's not easy. And it's made a lot harder because we're doing it by accident and we're doing it without a sort of an organised policy framework. And partly because South Australia wasn't caused by renewables. It was caused by sort of bad policy and a lack of coordination. But mistakes are going to happen, you know. And I think that really is, so we have this dichotomy between populism of renewables, but reticence for governments to impose any additional cost on households.
What about the idea of the rooftop solar being the answer to our prayers? There are people on our Facebook page saying, should be on every rooftop in the country. Is that going to fix things?
It's an interesting development. Australia's odd in the world because Australia is the only country we have by far and away the highest rooftop solar PV penetration in the world. It's a weird coincidence of events from the way the GST was negotiated, a little solar scheme started, the way solar panels fell in price, and we've ended up embracing solar as a domestic appliance when the rest of the world sees it as a utility power station. And so, look, it does help. It certainly saves. I've got hot solar on the roof at home. There's more than 2 million households have it. It's very popular. It cuts bills. but it's also creating technical challenges. So as Perth is approaching where at minimum demand, the grid may be run entirely by its rooftop solar PV by about 2025, and nobody knows how to run that grid under those conditions. So, yeah, we'll need to solve for that as well. We've got new experiments coming, and solar will be both a blessing and a challenge as it rolls out.
Rebecca, Sorry.
No, go for it.
No, solar's interesting to me because I'll make 2 points about that. I think over my period as a researcher, I think my perception is that people have gotten some mixed market messages about solar and about whether it's worth the investment or not. And of course, that hasn't been helped by the fact that government support for solar at a kind of household level has changed. But I think one of the things, the issues around solar and the issues around anything in terms of individual or household action on climate, it's this kind of idea that if I put solar panels on my house and, you know, use a reusable cup and ignore plastic straws, somehow that's going to deal with the climate issue. And I think that that's a very, very heavy burden to place on individuals and households. And I think that is why there is this kind of pent-up desire for something larger, a larger government framework. Because if we're thinking that we're going to deal with the challenges of climate through individual consumer choice and action, I think that is not realistic. And again, I think what it can do for people is make people think, look, this is just too much. I feel a mixture of burden, of guilt and frustration. And so then I'm just going to kind of give up and hope that somebody else will solve it. There'll be some kind of technological breakthrough or something. So I don't necessarily think the messages sent with the idea of rooftop solar, although it's a good idea, are necessarily helpful for the broader climate change fight.
And Matthew Warren, we've seen a big debate this week about the various parties' costings of a shift towards renewables, as the election looms, it's just bandying about of figures. Can we make the shift necessary to avoid catastrophic climate change without blowing out the budget? And are you seeing that commitment in either of the major parties' policies?
I mean, it's cheapest if you don't do anything, of course, we're now faced with having not done anything substantially for 10 years. We now have this devastating challenge of the large coal-fired power stations closing. They were built in the post-war boom. They're reaching about 50 years old and they're exiting. We've seen that with one in South Australia and one in Victoria. Liddell is going next in New South Wales. We know the names of the coal-fired power stations like the Seven Dwarves. You know, they're almost like familiar. And that's a really troubling place to be. So very large chunks of power are exiting the grid and we're forced to replace them. And it takes 7 years to build a new coal-fired power station. Nobody can finance them because the risk is too high. It'll take at least 10 years just to build the governance around a nuclear system, which we don't even legalise. So we're forced to replace this. And we've seen in the absence of policy to do that, prices have increased because there's not enough electrons. And it's this kind of crazy game where we have a federal government's solution is to suppress prices without actually fixing the underlying problem of a lack of electrons, which is the problem in the first place.
And it is also important to note that certainly in the research I've done, if you ask people, is electricity going to be more expensive in the future? And you can kind of give them different time horizons in the next 5 to 10 years. They think it's going to be more expensive in the future, regardless of whether we keep the current energy model in place or we make a more aggressive transition to renewables. And I think one of the things they have got is exactly the point Matthew was trying to make, which is that a lack of action on this has meant that we're kind of stuck. There's not necessarily always the social license to invest in new coal power. It's difficult. It's politically difficult. But then again, people do worry about that kind of sharp transition to renewables. So we're kind of stuck. And then they kind of see that, in fact, there is an incredible cost of lack of political coordination and lack of bipartisanship on this issue.
Well, I found reading both your works very, very interesting and inspiring in that sense, particularly the line from Matthew, "I don't think this needs to be as hard as we are making it." Words to live by. Thank you both so much for talking with us on Life Matters today.
Thanks, Hilary.
Thank you.
Rebecca Huntley is a social researcher and expert on social trends and the author of the latest quarterly essay, Australia Fair, Listening to the Nation. And Matthew Warren's book is called Blackout, How is Energy-Rich Australia Running Out of Electricity? He's an economist and a journalist.